are now listening to the Serious Growth Podcast with your host, Leo Costa Jr.
I would say these are not your golden years, right? Yeah,
whoever said that was full of crap.
Perhaps there's a little bit too much glow in that terminology, yeah. But you know.
Exactly. Hey, what do you have behind you? What kind of a screen do you have behind you?
Is that it's actually just a big old drape.
Oh, okay.
You know, you kind of have to make use of everything in a multi-purpose way right now. So this side is for stuff like this. And okay. I'm building a sound booth, which on this side has like the
insulator
audio type of stuff. I have some of those sound conditioners you have in that portion of the area.
Okay.
I like your setup. The brick is, I love brick.
It's made out of wood or something or plastic. I don't know what it is. It's fake.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought of it.
Did I ruin everything?
It still has the wonderful warm.
Okay.
So all good.
just erase that from your mind.
It would be so nice if we could do that, right? Just go zip.
Oh, God. Well, you know what?
That could be scary.
The crazy thing is, as you probably know, the most powerful thing in the world is thought.
Yeah.
And it's hard to control, you know, it's a very difficult thing. It would just be easy if we could just do it, just erase it.
It would be, but then we would never grow, would we? Or have the option to choose what to think regularly.
Well, that is true.
My gosh.
we're getting deep already.
I know. Holy moly. We're not even officially started, but it's wonderful to see your smile and
nice to meet you. Nice meeting you. Tom's told me a lot about you.
So, he's been such a wonderfully warm man.
I know. How long have you known him?
You know what? I only met him once in person. We shared a magazine together, which you probably mentioned. We got a little article. And so we connected that way through the publisher and writer of the magazine.
Okay.
And then we just sort of stayed in touch. And so what was that? Maybe a year? No, time has flown in Corona. Maybe 2 years, something like that.
Yeah, I know. I have kind of a similar story as you do, but that happened already probably, I don't know, 30 years ago. I've known Tom.
30 years.
Yeah, I don't even know how we met. It's been that long.
Wow.
I think it was over a manual that we ended up doing. I'm in training, physical training, and I wrote all these bodybuilding books back in the 90s or late 80s.
And Beyond Belief being one of them, correct?
Pardon me?
Beyond Belief being one
big,
of them?
Big Beyond Belief.
Yeah.
And then Tom came on and we wrote my background is in sports specific type of training. Mm-hmm. So I can develop different programs. And Tom, we developed a training program based on martial arts and we called it Explosive Power. Tom was a part of that.
Yeah.
That's how I met him. And you know, some people, I don't know about you, but there's been some people in my life now at this point that have just been around forever. And some are just very short-lived. I find that very interesting at times. You know, why do some people hang around and then some don't? I don't know if you have that, you know, that same situation. But Tom's been one of those that has been around. We're like a couple of old women now that just check on each other. We check to make sure that we're still alive.
Oh, my gosh. You know, the oldest friends can be such huge gifts. And
they are.
This earnest relationships,
which are
rare.
It is really true.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because the last time I was with Tom was at a restaurant.
Okay.
And you know, he has trouble hearing a little bit.
Yeah.
So between Tom and I, we can actually order something at this restaurant, you know.
Oh,
he can't hear, I can't see. He can see, I can't hear. Or he can't hear, I can't see very well. So between the both of us, we made a really good duo to order our food. It was pretty hysterical, actually.
Hey, it takes balance, a partnership sometimes. Yeah,
you had to be there anyway.
Oh, goodness.
Listen, welcome to Serious Growth Podcast. I appreciate you taking the time to come on.
Thank you for having me.
I've been looking over your bio. So what I'm curious to know is this.
Yeah.
I know as a trainer, when I do a consultation for somebody,
right,
it's a fact-finding process. So
when you
come to me, All I'm really doing is asking questions to listen to what's on your mind. And usually people will tell you what's on their mind in the order that of most important to the least important, or sort of a chronological order. It's something that people do that don't not aware of. So I see you, the way you've listed out here, you're actress, model, author, martial arts artist, healthy food lover. Is it in that order? Did you start off as an actress, or how did this all how did this whole bio thing work for you?
Wow, I guess we're ever in evolution, or hopefully getting into our most optimal place, right?
Yeah.
So prior to that, which isn't listed, my first major life growth experience was as a on-camera journalist, trained in the Senate Press Corps, then got general assignment reporting gig and fill an anchor position with a CNN affiliate in Orlando. And did that, and I loved so much of it, but I could not imagine doing it for all kinds of passion and a little bit of principles, in the long run in my life that I just couldn't imagine. So after I went to Germany to be a journal, you know, a representative of US journalism, and I thought, if this doesn't float my boat at this level of people I'm getting to, you know, get personal and professional understandings with, then I probably am in the wrong line of the marathon. Yeah. So I came back and I quit, and 2 months later, God answered my prayer for like help and provision and direction. And I got a job first as a model, and second, right after that, I mean, I had to pay my rent, right? And he takes care of, you know, his kids. And so I got written into a show, one of the few that's ever really shot for any long term in Florida. And I was like, oh, this is what I've always wanted to do as a child, but it was never the right and proper thing, which is why I went into journalism. Because on the face, it seems like it would be a lot more community service oriented, but realized in the pure essence of that storytelling desire is really having the most distilled version of any presentation of information, or just a person's humanity growing and changing. And so that's why, from a journalist, I immediately became actor model. And then in the last two decades of my life, where unexpected things happen, I had to grow into different things to, I'll be quite frank and say heal, and be able to carry on what I still believe my life mission is.
All right, let's take a quick break so I can tell you about our product.
Do you want a bone-crushing grip? Good, because you're going to get one with the amazing new TRS Gripper. It's a progressive grip builder with longer handles and a special ergonomic design that's like a dozen hand grippers in one. Start off easy and work your way up to quickly build your grip strength from wet noodle to pulverizing. The package includes a video from the world-famous strength coach, Dr. Russ Horine, the man who worked with Leo Costa to help bring you big beyond belief in the Bulgarian Power Burst. Dr. Horine shows you a simple and easy to follow workout plan that takes just minutes a day right from in front of your TV set if you want. So click on the link below and let's get started building you a stronger, firmer, bone-crushing grip.
Okay, so journalism, is that something that you thought that you wanted to do, or did you study that like in high school or something, in college? How did you get inside of it?
Funny, because, you know, I think children speak truth, whether, and they don't usually mean to, right? So my mom and dad would tell me, oh, as a kid, you'd say, I want to do that thing on the television. Yeah. And we didn't get to watch TV much because I was under lock and key, like seriously, with my Korean background. But so I guess like over the years, because I articulated that very young, they groomed my thoughts into, well, if you do that thing on the TV, you should do it like Connie Chung. See what she's doing, and you could serve the community. You would make us so proud, and it'd be such a good thing to do, and you have to study hard and do all these things. So I was like, well, this makes sense. I could do that thing on the TV. I thought whatever that was, I had no idea what the thing in the TV was at the time. And I was like, journalism. Yeah, that sounds right. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, that happened very young. So as a Bruin, they didn't have communication. Well, they had communication, but they didn't have journalism. So right. I did comm studies and added lots of little things here and there and a lot of community activism and, you know, philanthropy. And that's how the journalism thing.
So did you get like, would I be accurate in saying you were found then by like a network like CNN from all the stuff that you were doing?
Well,
talking about?
I guess found is such a strange
or discovered.
Well, I was really fortunate to have a good pick of well respected and powerful in that industry agents who wanted to represent me.
Okay. So
although I had done the work and gotten tape and footage that, you know, anyone on that thing, TV or film wants to be on, getting into those doors are hard, yeah. You know? So yeah. So it was nice to have agents that were like, we're going to do that part. And they did. So I think that's why I got to start in such a large market, although it was a tough way to start because I did my own camera work and writing and pretty much everything, like a small town, but in a big city.
Yeah,
so that's how the journalism thing happened. And I always love to write and learn about people and find the best thing to do on their behalf, because as a Korean woman, that's how the culture is, you know, find the best way to make your country proud, help your community, serve others, and do it with great propriety. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Now, are your parents, are you all from here? You born here in the U.S.?
I was actually born in Seoul, Korea.
Oh,
and
okay.
Yeah, we immigrated right before I was three and landed here in Los Angeles. And yeah, my parents, I'm really just, they're such, what an amazing immigrant story, you know? They grew me up with all the cultural aesthetics and mores that I think I love about being Korean, but really wanted to do everything they could to make sure that I was of service to this country in whatever way that could be, you know? So education and give back always with all that you can. And, you know, so we became naturalized citizens as soon as they took all the tests. And I remember them saying, because we're doing this, you don't have to do this later, you know? So they did it as early as possible. And
that's pretty amazing that they did that.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine how that process is. I know it's not easy for, you know, for people who come have really nothing except other Korean family members. And
it's overwhelming, especially when it's a little bit different. I think when they came and did that, I did it with my second wife.
Mm-hmm.
And by then when she came, she's from Europe.
Yeah.
She went through the process. This is when Homeland Security took over immigration, and a whole different ball game. I mean, a lot more red tape because of what, you know, some stuff that happened.
Right.
Or it was not to say that it wasn't overwhelming, because I mean, coming from another country like your parents did, that in itself has got to be overwhelming. I'm thinking of, you know, me going to Europe and not knowing language and things like that. You know, it has to be overwhelming. So to make it, that is quite an amazing story, no doubt about it. But it became more convoluted for like us when we were trying to get her naturalized. Ooh,
yeah,
frustrating, actually. Very frustrating. And lots of money and lots of the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. And you know, you gotta it didn't make it easy. And maybe that was part of the process, you know, not just anybody. You had to have that will to, you know, but
yeah,
life's kind of like that, though.
I was just going to, you know, parallel that to your like physical fitness career and getting yourself and other people over those really treacherous passes, you know, it's a literal war of attrition for the long haul. And sometimes it's literally the last person staying at the door knocking.
Yeah.
I'm not going to leave. And you're not going to go to sleep until you enter the door.
Yeah. There's a lot of truth to that, you know? And I was lucky just like you. My parents, I come from a background, Portuguese, and the dairy industry is really big in our culture. And, you know, and I don't know about you, it kind of sounded like you talked a little bit in the beginning. Like with me, in my culture, it was expected in a way to, for the dairy industry to be left to the next generation. And I broke that cycle, which back then it was like a bad boy, a rebel a little bit, you know what I mean? And I don't know, like, in your culture, if it's like that. I mean, my parents forgave me. It wasn't like they disowned me. But it was like, you know, the aunts and the uncles, why are you letting that kid go off and go to college, for goodness sake? You know, that kind of thing.
Wow.
And kind of like, why doesn't he just do a normal job instead of doing the job that I ended up getting into, which I'm glad that I followed my own path. But it sounds like you kind of went down the path that way too and found your thing.
You could say that.
Yeah. But let me ask you, as a journalist and working for like CNN, did you do a lot of traveling?
You know, no, because it was a local level. So it was, you know, your local news is what we did.
Okay.
So, I mean, the traveling was only within our region, you know what I mean? Because then there's network level news, and most of those correspondents will probably travel more than, say, the local affiliates. A journalist. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So, you know, that was sort of like the entry level, right? And then the whole projection of, do I really want to be like the next Katie Couric and spend the next 15, 20 years going after that morning network job, which is like what the long-term vision as a journalist was? I was like, I don't think so. So anyway,
What was the first time that you went out on a story? I'm going to compare that to the first time I competed on stage. I was like, my first show in bodybuilding, because I competed there.
Yeah.
I mean, I trained thousands and thousands of hours, and we had to do our own choreography. And Jane, I have to tell you, the first time I went out on stage, I don't even remember what happened, to tell you.
Oh, no.
Well, it was, you know, I had so much training underneath my belt that I did fine. Was it like that for you to go out like on your first big gig? Were you scared out of your wits, or how did that work out for you? Were you calm and cool and collected?
I think for looking back on a lot of things, journalism and my first acting job and stuff, I'm just, you know, I think it was that I was just so determined that, well, this is what I'm supposed to be doing, so I guess it will just be okay. I never had the I guess in similarly to you, where I don't remember a lot because you're so in the moment, which I think is the beautiful thing about any kind of expression, whether physicality or the arts or, you know, emotional processes. It's just getting so entrenched and lost and invested and disappear that you don't remember where you were, how you were, who you were. And yeah, so I don't remember a lot of things, say, from the early few days of journalism, other than going, I'm not sure I know how to work this camera very well yet. That the technical stuff like was like, oh my goodness. You know, but that all just came because I happen to love doing stuff with my hands. Just like my first acting gig that I was written into, I just remember going, okay, I'm supposed to be here. I don't know what the heck I'm doing. But for, I think the naiveness that I had for most of my life and in everything, and I'm still charged with being naive at times.
I think it could be a mixed blessing.
Yeah. So just having the first time experiences or the first few experiences, bringing the, I know I'm here for a purpose deep down in there somewhere, it kept the freak out and the fear at bay, helped me be in a place where I wasn't all about control, because there's nothing I can control. I was just there to be there and serve and hopefully do my job, which evidently I was able to do in both careers keep going for a while.
And the reason why I asked that is because in athletics, I was always an athlete. When you first get into, when you go to these different levels, you know, as you go up and you get to a bigger game, so to speak, the game is faster. Everything is faster at that level. And I'm sure that as you went up, things move faster, and because it's a different level. I'm guessing. Yeah. But what happens is with athletics, and I'm sure it happened with you because it sounds like that's what you're saying, is as the more that you keep doing it, the game starts slowing down. And I was able to enjoy those moments being out on stage in a way that I never could have in the beginning. So through that repetition being the mother of skill, I could actually see the crowd, and I could actually enjoy playing to the crowd. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that happens to you as an actress or when you were, you know, interviewing people and being in that moment, because I think as somebody who's interviewing, you're on stage. And a part of, I mean, you are interviewing somebody, but you're also, I would think, trying to make that an interesting interview.
Yeah, so you're still talking about my former career as a journalist.
Yes, I'm going back and forth here, but right now we're...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the whole sense of, you know, what I was instilled as a child of being the, you know, utmost in propriety, it helped if I wasn't really sure what was happening with the satellites or the cameras, that I was just still had to be so present, you know, in service of the other person, that all the other things on my worry list had to take back seat. Yeah. So,
That definitely changes the focus for sure when you're, when you're thinking that way.
Yes, but also like when you're getting more mature or getting bigger opportunities or bigger stories or bigger roles on something on, you know, TV or film, it's kind of, you've come to that place where some of the basics are so ingrained in you, and that repetitive character holds you when you need to just let yourself be free. Yeah. And without that anchor or that built-in habit, I guess, or knowing, you wouldn't be able to just let loose, because to be free, ironically, you do need some sort of structure.
Absolutely. We call that repetition as a mother of skill.
Yes.
And then we did that in training, because you can't, what you're talking about is it's the difference between thinking about everything that you're doing as opposed to reacting. That's how I'm translating what you're saying, because that's what happens with us in athletics. If you get to a spot where you're thinking, well, you're going to be dead in the water, you know, especially at that level, it's moving that fast. It's got to be reactionary, but it just doesn't happen. And that's what a lot of people don't know. They don't realize all the work that you put in, you know, in your, your acting. I'm just guessing, to make that look, you know, seamless and easy. It's never easy, I don't think.
Well, and so many teachers and actors have said, if they can catch you acting, you haven't done your job.
Right.
You know, so, you know, and sometimes it's not just on the actor, because it takes a whole entire community to build any kind of film, TV episode, or, you know, so it could just be the directing, or it was, they had to take that take because there wasn't enough take. So what doesn't read well is all they have. So there's so much more that goes into it than just, say, the actor's presence or distracted, you know, capture.
Yeah.
But for the most part, unless you have done the work and put in the time, as an actor, lived as this person in the way that your preparation leads you to, then the magic won't ever happen.
Yeah, and I think you were fortunate like me. My dad taught me how to work at a very young age. I think your parents taught you a very good work ethic. And, you know, that's part of the stuff that's dragged me through life at times, you know, and I'm sure it did you. I have a question for you. The first, now we're going to talk about your acting. Your career a little bit. The first gig that you went on, was it a part that you read for? Like some lines that you had to read?
I did have to go audition, but this was after, and I never do this now, so it's funny that this is how my acting career started, because I had gone to a dinner party with one of the current cast members who was a friend, and he's like, just why don't you just come to dinner with me and we'll have fun at this gathering party thing.
Yeah.
And I wasn't there for anything, just to hang out with my friend, right? Yeah. So in the process of that, I guess the producers of that show were there and we talked and hung out or whatever. I mean, and it wasn't even a long dinner. I think I was there for a couple hours. I'm like, I gotta go. I have things to do in the morning. Yeah. And then a couple days later, I get a call that, oh, they're interested in writing you into the show. What? Really? Okay. And then I had to actually start the process of, here's what you do. I didn't even know what an audition was for an actor. I'm like, what do I do? Yeah. So I did that thing. I went into the casting office, prepared these lines. I probably sucked really badly because I didn't know what I was doing. I'm just showing up going, I did the best I knew how, which I didn't know very much because I wasn't an actor really at that time. And then I guess I wasn't as horrible as I could have been because they just moved ahead and, you know, I think I shot 3 or 4 episodes. I was like, is this how the industry works? This is crazy.
Yeah.
It's never that easy, but it's always, for me, always been very, very, I mean, I don't like using the word magical, but I see how things were woven together when it was my utter failing that somehow something happened and then I got the gig, or so many different paths had to cross in the most unplannable moments that then something happened. Always with some bigger picture in mind. It's been a wild thing to observe in retrospect.
I would think, though, at a party like that, it was a look that they saw maybe your personality, something that immediately drew them. I mean, wouldn't you think that was part of the deal?
Well,
obviously, you hadn't read any lines, so they didn't know anything about your acting ability. So I'm thinking it's a look. It's, you know what I mean? Like in modeling, I've heard that. A certain look. The camera loves you, and you know, which it does, by the way. You're very beautiful, but I wonder if it was just something like that, you know, and the fact that maybe you're just authentic. You screwed up, you sucked, but maybe it was an authentic suck, and you know what I mean? Maybe that was part of the magic, if you will. I don't know.
I mean, I think there is a definite charm in not being overdone, right, in anything.
Right.
And so I went from that one end of the spectrum to then probably overdoing because of the work ethic that I've learned from my parents and having to do things right and perfect and, you know, excellent all the time. Yeah. And so I overworked and then got to the other place, you know, not too long after the bumbling, who knows, wide-eyed. Yeah. I'm just here because I'm happy to be here, self, which I still am, but now it's interesting because we're talking about this during the worldwide pandemic, because a lot of these things, these structures I had built for myself as either safety or my perspective on the best way of the arts, or, you know, building outreaches or serving the church or whatever, all these inner things of you have to be perfect and all those things that really actually prevent you from doing things to the utmost and well, you know, perfection being the enemy of progress. I impeded so much of my own progress with the best intentions. But in times like this, where our real work right now is to really master ourselves so that when we all reemerge, we can be the best for one another, you know? So it's like digging all those unnecessary things and habits and ideas and thoughts that I thought were of good service and possibly served me, maybe because I want to be a little controlling about everything being just so, you know, because that's just how I was raised, that this quarantine's been a part of my long journey in my own almost decade and a half of physical healing. To really tackle like the deepest emotional things, because as an actor, you're always digging deep and getting to places that are messy and people don't want to deal with, but that's our job, you know, to be the human and alive. So uncovering anything that may prevent that flow has been a lot of the work that you mentioned before that non-artist people don't see or don't fully understand, that the beauty comes from like totally dying to yourself.
Exactly.
You know, and serving the story or your personal life mission. So,
you know, Jane, it takes, it's just same way. And again, bodybuilding, you know, there's so, that sport is so unforgiving. Again, I was an athlete all my life, but bodybuilding, getting into that was a really interesting sport just because it's just, I mean, you're constantly giving up something. Talking about digging deep. I'm not feeling sorry for myself, but it's just that, you know, most of the people that want to be an actor, and again, I'm just guessing, like most of the people that want to get on stage as a bodybuilder never make it there because they don't really understand when they first get into something like this just how much digging you're going to have to do. And it's a marathon, and it's there's a lot of disappointment along the way because you're learning your craft. Again, I'm speaking as a, you know, someone who, but it's just, you know, not everybody is willing to make that sacrifice. And it doesn't really matter, I don't think, what industry it's in, whether it's you being an actor like you are and digging down like that, or an athlete, because that's part of the reason why I like interviewing people from all walks of life, because I think there's really a lot more that we have in common as a process to get to where you're getting and to where I've gotten as an athlete. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's kind of similar, you know, that you have to get that. And you talk about being perfect, and that, you know, interestingly enough, I got into fashion. I would have never thought that as a bodybuilder, I didn't care what I looked like with clothes on. I looked homeless. You know, all I cared about was what I looked like on stage in trunks.
Right.
I even had people make that comment. Anyway, so I get into fashion, and the thing that I learned about fashion that I like, and I'm really attracted to people like in your industry, I'm attracted to people that take something that's hard and they make it look easy. In Italy, Italian fashion, they call that sprezzatura. It's making the hard look easy. You know how you see some of these actors on camera, it's just like, oh, they're so, I mean, it just doesn't seem like there's any acting whatsoever. It's so real and it's so easy. And if you're too perfect, I don't think you can pull that off. Mm-mm. Do you?
No, I mean, I think the structured striving for perfectionism was an extension, I guess you could say, of my own way that my parents were like, achieve, you know, top of the game, achieve. And the formulaic approach that I had built my entire life, which I still fight, is to just work hard, do my best, apply myself, and it's gonna be great. And for most of, you know, whether it's academia, you know, to some degree journalism, in those a little bit more structured places, that worked because it was kind of a meritocracy to some degree. Like, how many awards could I win? How many like straight A's and, you know, achievements could I rack up to then make me deserving for the next something?
Yeah.
And then when it became into something that was artistic and expressive and lacking structure, because this industry is, well, currently right now, it's a very dormant industry, although I have a shoot coming up this weekend, which should be eye-opening. There can be no structure. Anything that you presume or judge the script about or the character you're looking at about, I mean, it's not truthful, you know, and to be vulnerable and truthful and willing to go somewhere where you have nothing to catch you, it still freaks me out because it's not who I'm comfortable with, although it's becoming more of how I live. because I still want things in an organized, proper fashion. And there really can be no expectation of reaction or proprietary ways of planning a relationship with someone. And then the relationship you have with yourself and all the memories of the current and the past and the hopes for the future as a human that you're applying to a story that's supposed to connect somehow to millions of people through that weird digital interface. You know, so it's like the only way it survives all those screens of, you know, the screen that you're watching it, the editing, the post-production, the, you know, then the technical stuff on set, the only way like one soul can touch another is if it's so pure, it makes it through all those filters.
It's an interesting analogy. I like that.
Oh, well, it's just because you asked the question. I'm like, this is how I see it.
No, I was in your head with you. I mean, you were taking me right through that. It's an interesting analogy. I'm curious to know. Now, I know the answer because you're still, I mean, you have a lot of stuff that you're doing, but this is more for maybe somebody else that's watching this. Sure. How do you handle having a bad audition or having a, you know, not all your parts are going to go great. Some of your movies are going to, you know, how do you handle that? I mean, it's so personal.
Oh.
And, you know, it's a creative act and you got so many critics. And look, it's a part of the game. I'm not, you know, look, right. Nobody's feeling sorry for anybody, but it's a part of the game. It's a reality. How do you handle that? How do you handle that setback when you know it's like, I'm sure maybe, have you ever had those moments like, you know, no, I'm in the wrong field, you know, but yet you bounce back. What's that? What goes on with you and how do you read?
Oh gosh. Oh.
Don't start crying.
I'm actually like,
no meltdown on me.
Fuddled about how to answer this.
Be authentic. Just be authentic.
You know, I mean, it's a question that comes up every day. And before, I think we started this when we were just, you know, connecting early on, it was, well, how do you, now I totally lost my train of thought because my mind just went.
How do you rebound from a bad performance? How do you get over that?
I really have a hard time with that. And it's because I still have a hard time with that because I want more than anything to be of the best service possible. And sometimes it doesn't work out as well as I had hoped.
Right.
Whether it's in an audition or whether it's on set. I remember, I mean, part of the reason why this is something that threatens to plague me, but I have to just go, okay, no, God, I trust you more than the doubts that are trying to permeate my life.
Yeah.
It's about going, okay, even in this that I messed up or I forgot something or I just honestly didn't show up as well as I wished and intended, whether it's for a friend or whether it's on camera, like, okay, what could I have done better, if anything? And I'm going to entrust you with my my perceived failing to redeem it. So one, I will have grown in as a human, as an artist, as a friend, or, you know, and then let me have another go somehow. So I struggle with this because part of my more emerging history has to do with physical healing of physical healing. I'll leave it at that for right now, you know, because I've had accidents in my life as well as a recent battle with cancer.
Ooh.
You know, so it's just when my body is failing me and I'm supposed to bring it to the greatest service for this message I believe in, or this story that serves still, again, my life purpose, which I'm feeling like I need to really keep focused on that instead of doing all the good in the world I possibly can, which is how I wanted to be, which just help everyone do everything as possible. If I'm like, wait a minute, that's not how anyone's supposed to live their life.
Right.
But to combat those doubts or those down falls without getting too low crested, it's hard. I deal with it differently every time. Sometimes I'm like, I'm just going to go have an amazing vegan ice cream with lots of chewy things.
Yeah.
And sometimes I just get in my little prayer closet and I go, God help me. Because that was very disappointing. Ugh. And sometimes it takes a long time, but it's the constant repetition of, oh, this is what I was getting at, that we were talking about, is what you're tempted to think about and what you choose to stay your thoughts on, you know? So the temptation, I think, for any artist or any person who expresses themselves on stage, on film, like it doesn't matter, is knowing what is crap. And it's often the temptation to see all the bad that you have done or how well you didn't do, and instead go, no, what is the better thing? What is the better, more excellent way to look at that? And then it's a fight to get there.
Let's take a quick pause to tell you about something you are definitely going to want.
Do you want a bone-crushing grip? Good, because you're gonna get one with the amazing new TRS Gripper. It's a progressive grip builder with longer handles and a special ergonomic design that's like a dozen hand grippers in one. Start off easy and work your way up to quickly build your grip strength from wet noodle to pulverizing. The package includes a video from the world-famous strength coach, Dr. Russ Horine, the man who worked with Leo Costa to help bring you big beyond belief in the Bulgarian Power Burst. Dr. Horine shows you a simple and easy to follow workout plan that takes just minutes a day right from in front of your TV set if you want. So click on the link below and let's get started building you a stronger, firmer, bone-crushing grip.
One of the things that I've always done with myself is I always do better when I get myself out of the being overwhelmed and controlled by everything that's overwhelming me state to the getting into a proactive state. Even if it's just asking, and you mentioned this, you're alluding to that, is ask the question, what could I have done better? And then make sure that I eliminate that potential mistake next time. Okay, let it go. Yeah. And I think that's a part of, for me, what helps is compartmentalizing stuff, because I think it's important to actually deal with stuff, not run away from it, but deal with it, but not to the point where it destroys you, where it's all of a sudden you're like, I can't get out of bed tomorrow or for another month to go to an audition or, you know, to a bodybuilding show, whatever.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so that's one of the ways that I process my stuff, because I had three strokes 8 years ago that devastated me, paralyzed me. And I had to dig way deep, and kind of similar to your physical healing. I understand where you're at. And compartmentalization was a big thing for me because, you know what, if, you know, I was worried about, well, can I not be stressed out in life anymore? Because I'm a high-strung person, emotional, I've been told. I stress has to be in my life. I can't live flat. I can't live on drugs, and I can't live flat. No. That's not who I am, right? So compartmentalization always helped. And so I can deal with stress. I put it in a box after about 24 hours, and I move on. It's a technique that I use. You know, it's having a short memory. And the other thing is the having the motivation has to be greater than the obstacle, because you are not going to have great performances all the time.
Right.
And that's just reality. And if you can't do that, and yet it's so funny because, you know, Tom and I have talked before, like he's amazing to me because he says, I feel more comfortable when I actually have bullets flying by my head, because he's trained that way. You learn how to train in, you know, be comfortable in the uncomfortable, but that isn't, that's easy to do, because you have to keep going to these spots that are painful sometimes when you've had a bad outing, right? Yeah.
Oh, yes.
That's true. And then I think what even, you know, when the motivation's gone, then what? Well, then that's where discipline comes in. Because I think discipline, you know, it overrules even the motivation and the obstacle. Because when I'm dealing with people, Jane, that are wanting to come in and drop weight or change their body, You know, right. At first they're like, when they started, like in a, you know, when you first have a new boyfriend or girlfriend, it's really, yeah, everything's really exciting. And, but then the honeymoon eventually comes to an end.
Right.
Then what? Right. That's when it is so interesting, because people oftentimes they actually quit in a spot where they're just getting ready to make some gigantic breakthroughs.
Right.
And I think it comes down to the motivation is no longer there all the time like it was before, because everything was hot and heavy in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Have that discipline to get up, get your butt off your, you know, out of bed, take that step towards going to that audition and kill it.
Right. I mean, you speak like such wisdom, because it's always the person's why that will take them over or under or through whatever that wilderness is, whatever that area of feeling lost is, whatever the inner or outward obstacles are. I mean,
or loneliness, for goodness sake.
Especially loneliness. You know, it's such a lie that we're alone, or we're tempted to keep thinking, oh, I'm so doing this all by myself. Yeah. No, that's not the truth, even though it may seem that way.
No, that's
and it's
right.
A lie you chose to believe at some point, and now you've given it permission to stay. Well, no, you have to actually uproot that lie in your life and ask for God to show you the truth of what it is. And then you might see that you actually have friends who love you, or my dog just got up, or a dog who will never leave your side, you know? So I think especially now, I know I am, I think many people are in this long haul. How am I going to deal with every day? Still live my purpose, whatever your purpose is that you know is only yours, and then maintain that why to get through these dark patches where this isn't even a patch. Now this is like a long old, who knows how long it's going to be.
Yeah, that's for sure. So, in the beginning of the show, we talked about thought being the most powerful thing in the world. Yeah. And it's hard to harness that, you know, when you get into times like this. And it's an ongoing fight, at least for me. I'm going to change up here a little bit. I want to talk about the martial arts, right?
I have interesting diverse training background. I've always loved the arts, and it was also one of those things. Oh, sorry, baby. My little doggy got freaked about something that I also wanted to do as a child, but then didn't until I went off to college. My first sensei, who I love, Sensei Lin Kobayashi, he so interesting, like his students, and I would win all kinds of form competitions because they were so beautiful and intricate and practical and deadly, yet fluid and fantastic. And the application of it was so just really well thought out, you know? So it was Kenpo and Sabat and other kinds of boxing with Muay Thai involved. So he kind of created, you know, a kind of MMA, but this was long time before, you know, MMA was coined. And also taught some things about women's safety and such. So he was my first sensei. And then when I moved to be a journalist in Florida, I got my black belt in Taekwondo because I wanted to honor my heritage and my parents. And then I also started training with someone named Mike Bell, who I believe is a boxing Hall of Famer. And he had his own style that he was training me in. And so I really loved when he challenged me to just put on, like, you know, you'd see in old 80s fighting movies where, you know, when they're training, they have to be in the dark and wear cover their eyes. So he would have me do things in, you know, like that. And then we'd do rounds on the bag. And so I just loved all kinds of martial movement. So I don't have just one kind of background. And something I did incorporate was learning a little bit of Kung Fu and Qigong in these years when breath and healing with power was still important, because a lot of the training I did was force to force, which as a woman probably wasn't the best idea. I just love those really hard fighting styles, you know? But they've certainly, having my body familiar with that kind of movement has served well in various, you know, action-ish projects. And and God willing, there's a one that we've been working on nearly for a decade now that would have me in necessitating some extreme training with, you know, revisiting, you know, my martial capacity. So, I love all of it.
Does the fact that you are a black belt, does that give you like an amazing confidence within? I mean, you know, look, being a female, I don't know if I'm not saying that like you're weaker, but I mean, to be a woman and to be able to handle yourself, I would think would give you great confidence.
Yeah, I would say it's not something, say, like I walk around thinking all the time, but in the depths of who I am, I'm like, I know if push came to shove, I would be fine.
Yeah, well, I think that's important.
Because
I think people can sense that. You know, it's just like I'm going to use another analogy. It's probably a bad one. A horse that you ride. The horses can sense when you're scared.
Oh, yeah.
And they're going to buck you off.
Yes.
I learned that because I used to ride a lot of horses in rodeos. And they sense that. I think humans are the same way. They sense when you're afraid, you know?
And
for me, it's very, I feel a lot more confident when I know I'm confident because I know that person over there knows that too. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe it's a false sense of security, but I would think that would be a great thing for you.
Yes, I think it's really valuable for anyone to have that kind of physical, just knowing of what they're capable of, you know? And so I think it's great when parents take their children to learn some of this, especially the vocalization for women of no, and really meaning it and making sure it lands. So there's no question.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And, that's sometimes hard to do, strangely.
Yeah.
So I think that's really, really important for children to start out having their boundaries comfortable for them, you know, and sometimes it has to be through physicality because everything resides in our mortal members somewhere, you know, memories or hurts or pains or joys, it all remains with you until you say and get rid of it if it doesn't belong, you know. So having that confidence instilled early takes up positive, helpful, protective space in a being, you know. So I think it's a good move for parents to do something like that.
You've done quite a few quite a few movies. Where my assistant, my partner over here, we just watched he showed me what Reno 911 was. I remember seeing some of those we were laughing our butts off in here. But you've done quite a bit of stuff. What's been your favorite, or do you have a favorite that you've done, movies or any of these episodes?
Oh my God.
Are they all kind of like, they're all good but different? Is there one that stands out maybe?
All of them have some really great point of merit in my journey, honestly.
I understand that, by the way.
Oh, gosh.
I do. I get that. Yeah. But then I also notice here that you, it seems like, now, is this a cause? You're doing something now with bringing sex trafficking, right, for children?
Yes, you know, tying your two questions now together, one of my first serious acting roles had to do with me being a mom to a young girl who was kidnapped into the sex trade. And just seeing how rampant and pervasive that is underground in the United States. You know, I live in California, San Francisco, and Los Angeles and Long Beach are really high trafficking ports, you know, for people. people.
Yeah.
And so to have my career as an actor, not just as a model or a commercial on-camera talent, started with a project of that kind of depth and eye-opening awakening.
Yeah.
And because I've also been spared of, you only see things clearly in retrospect, but as a child, I encountered a lot of people that could have compromised me as a child, but something always happened at that crucial time where I know it was the grace of God that intervened and saved me from what could have been a torturous life, you know? And, but knowing that that's happening now, and the project my husband and I have been developing having to do with revealing the roots of sex trafficking, not in a documentary way, because a lot of great people are doing work in documentaries and bringing light to this often hidden trade. I can't even, it's a business. It's so disgusting. But to do it in a theatrical sense, you know, that's something that's of growing importance. That kind of ties in the last two questions.
Yeah. No, it sounds like it's like a cause for you. It's really important to you, sounds like.
Yes. And I'm looking forward to really being able to do more, because as you know, when you're physically healing, you really have to focus on where you invest your energies, right?
Yeah.
So for a good while now, I've been really focusing on, you know, allowing my body to heal from cancer and the brain injury that fried my nervous system, you know, so all these things. It was also when I realized I couldn't control much and I couldn't just make things happen no matter how much I applied myself. I actually have to change and allow things to happen, including just creating the environment of healing, whatever that looked like, because I wasn't about to do surgery or radiation, and no one knew what to do until I got cancer of the strange brain injury I got from a so-called medical device, you know. So it, you have to expect the unexpected, and I didn't expect these two things, you know, in the last 10 years of my life. So yeah. So figuring out a way I could still live my life purpose of serving others also then became, well, because I'm healing, I'm also called then to be a healer, and helping and praying and helping people really deal with their deepest things, which will then allow your body to open and heal instead of being in this, I'm just going to go achieve all the time and be the best in my field because I can. Yeah. Well, sometimes, as we've all seen in the pandemic and quarantine, we can't just go do something because we can.
Yeah.
Not only because it doesn't help you, but because it also doesn't serve those around you. Yeah. You know, so coming into a place of deep trust and quiet submission to something more than I know has been like the deepening part of this journey before I feel like I'm going to fully be able to get back out there, but as someone totally different. And I think a lot of us are in that space because of coronavirus stuff.
It's definitely a part of growing. I mean, it puts you out there. Yeah. Adapt or die in some ways. I see here that you published an inspirational nonfiction book. Why don't you tell us about that a little bit?
Oh my goodness. I have so many books in the works. But the one I did do, and he has other ones like print ready pretty much, is Rocky the Rescue, a collection of his rescue tales. And I never knew how incredible like every single life on this earth was until I got a dog who just blew me away. And then I got into gardening and got another rescue dog, and just seeing like this web of life instead of like a domineering human on top mastering life, you know? So it's in the early parts of that kind of realization about Rocky the Rescue, who's, he just had his 12th birthday and he's super, super like a puppy still. But I mean, this little dog was discarded in a trash bag to just die by humans in Los Angeles. And somebody heard their cries in the big garbage bin, picked up the bag, found, you know, the little litter and took them to get into a rescue type of situation. So I, long story short, I had prayed for a little pooch after I got married because I just really wanted one. And my husband was saying, no, we don't need a dog. We don't have time for a dog. And I'm like, God, I really want a little puppy. Will you please make me one that you know is the right one for me? And bring him to my doorstep was my prayer. So I'd know specifically it was mine. And that's what happened. Like the rescue agency said no to the other person who they took the application for, you know, Rocky. And then they said, okay, we're going to bring him to you and we're going to bring him to your door. So like his intersection of his life with mine have been marked with miracles, including him getting right back up after he was hit by a racing little red two-door sports car. Mm. And I would have, wow, God saved me from so much regret, because it was a time I just put him off leash because he's usually so good, you know, but not this day. After, you know, a week of rain, he was like, I'm going to be super dog all by myself. So he raced across the road and then he raced back. And when he was coming back toward me was when this red car came barreling down, hit him. He flew literally 25 feet. Wow. And people gathered around. I was expecting to see him just dead, but he raced across the intersection, and then a nice man I never met, you know, picked him up and was cradling him and was praying over him, you know, God, yeah, spare this one. Oh, and so I took him and took him home, found the nearest emergency vet. And my husband was home at the time because it was super early. I would take them like 6, 7 a.m. type of thing for a walk. But he was there and Rocky went to see him. And my husband said he smelled like death because every orifice in his body had released, you know?
Yeah.
And so I took him to the vet immediately. And when the vet, in an emergency situation, saw him and I told him what happened, he was like, are you sure this dog was in a car accident? He has a few scratches on him, but he's fine.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, oh my God, thank you, God. And then so we brought him home with some pain medication in case he had needed it. And he slept the rest of the day. Remember, it was December because we were supposed to go to our church for like our holiday show rehearsal. And we were like, we can't, gotta stay. I'm not having a vigil over my dog right now. Yeah. Not possible. And I just watched him sleep for hours and hours and hours. Like, keep breathing. Go, little guy. And he woke up that night. Hi, Mom. Let's play. Like, nothing happened. And in the meantime, I've just been like, oh, God, help him. I think he's great, but you never know, blah, 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 blah. And so that story is what compelled me to just write down some stories of how, yeah, he's shown the goodness of God, changed so many hearts toward animals, because he's such a gregarious, cool, fun guy, and kids, you know, got over their fear of dogs because of his charmingness. So that's what Rocky the Rescue is, and that book gives 90% back of all of the proceeds I get. Actually, I didn't even take proceeds. I was like, whatever I used to pay for it, doesn't matter. Any book that I sold, I always gave 90% of that to animal rescues. So yeah, that's what I hope to continue with all the books. He has a children's line of illustrated books that I'm waiting to find a publisher to do something with, and another children's book that I'm in the process of submissions and illustrating now.
I just got a, speaking of a rescue dog, I just got, yeah, not too long ago, about a year ago, I just got a dog that was, she was one of two other siblings that were dumped out in the middle of nowhere to die. You know, humans are really interesting sometimes when they do that. But I have to tell you something. I don't know who rescued, who, because you know what, since I've had this dog, she's changed me. I've had several people tell me that. And, you know, so I think maybe she rescued me more than I rescued her, to be quite honest with you. It's really pretty amazing, you know, what they bring to the table sometimes, you know, it really is. It's really heartwarming. And the thing that kills me though, is that you build such a, I'll speak for myself, so I've had dogs all my life.
Yeah.
And I built such a relationship with them. You get so close to them. It's, oh God, it's just like you think about it, one day, you know, one of us is going to, you know, that's going to be a nightmare. I hate that. Anyway, I don't want to end on a
crack. Oh my gosh.
Let's talk about really quick about what is your, you're a food lover. What exactly does that mean? Do you like to cook?
You know, I do love to cook. I love making and baking things that are healthier, life-giving renditions of the standard American fare, the standard American diet. Sad. It's very sad and very destructive, not only for people, but the planet. And so part of something, a show that I'm developing and had done before, had to do with, well, let's use food as the baseline for people to heal it and make the choices to allow our planet to be able to rejuvenate itself instead of being constant over consumers.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we treat anyone or anything else well in our best capacity, then I don't believe in karma. So let me just put that out there. But it's that web of life. It's not just karma, because there's so much evil in this world, karma can't explain that.
Right.
But it's just when you invest such goodness and love, knowing that that's precious because it's life of any form, then it nourishes you not only from that act, but because in the physiological realm, it also is protective and health promoting.
Yeah.
Well, so that's what the food stuff is about.
I got firsthand experience of that because when I had my strokes, I got a hernia from rehabbing myself. I had to rehab myself to get myself back because I was paralyzed.
Wow.
And thank goodness I had my sport and my background because I understood how to do that, right? But this is a testament to nutrition. Mm-hmm. I had to go to the doctor to see if I had any holes in my heart because they're going to put me under anesthesia to fix the hernia, and they didn't. Okay. They wanted to make sure I was 30% blocked overall, which is not bad at all. I was amazed at this. The doctor said we don't even stent and address people's when they're blocked like that till 70%, which I thought was horrifying.
Oh, but yeah.
I wanted to see if I could reverse heart disease nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
And for that next year, I changed my diet around, Jane, and I went back and I reversed heart disease another 15 or 20%. The doctors couldn't even believe it. So that goes to show you, it's kind of making a, you know, talking about what you're talking about. That's how powerful nutrition and food is. And, you know, it can make a huge difference in your life. There's no question about that.
Oh my gosh. Kudos to you for taking on that experiment and doing it.
Well, I'm real competitive that way. So, you know, when I was 30% blocked, I go, this is not good. I want to make it 20% or 10, you know, I want to change that. So that was kind of my goal.
God, you know,
for that next year, that was my goal, you know, anyway. So, hey, listen, this has been a really lovely interview with you, and I'm really glad that I get to meet you and that we both know somebody now in common, Mr. Tom Muzzella.
Yes.
And
hi, Tom, if you're going to watch at some point, hi. Yeah, anyway,
so I really do appreciate you taking the time out to come do the interview. Is there anything that you would like to promote on our show before we go off into the wilderness?
Oh, goodness. I know we all have our own wilderness right now. Well, I, you know, reflect the gratitude back to you. This was really a treat, and I love getting to see you and chat and make a really good, warm connection. Promotion. You know, the whole word makes me feel funny. Promotion. I would just say, you know, if you want to support animals, check out RockyTheRescue.com.
Nice.
If you want to learn more about how to heal yourself and the planet, go to eatscommunity.org. But it's all on my website. So just go to janeparksmith.com. And then I think there's more menu tabs about something other than my life on screen. That's the the deeper, more important stuff to me. So you can find all that, how to give back and learn how to take care of yourself and other people and all life.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Listen, you have a great light that surrounds you. You're really fun to, I can tell you're fun to be around and you're a positive person. So I appreciate meeting you. So maybe one of these days when I'm down in LA actually quite a bit. It's like my second home down there. I spend a lot of time in Venice Beach and Santa Monica area. Maybe one of these times, you never know, paths might cross if we can get this coronavirus out of here, you know?
Yes. And we all have to take care of each other.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Anyway. Through this.
Anyway, nice talking to you. And I'll see you again sometime.
Okay.
Thank you,
Jane. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Serious Growth Podcast. For more episodes like the one you just listened to, subscribe to us on your mobile podcast app and leave us a review. If you'd like to reach out, you can find us online at seriousgrowth.com. Until next time, train smart and train hard.